So what's the verdict? Was what is now KCBS really the country's first radio station?
Absolutely.
KCBS In Depth, a spontaneous and unrehearsed interview with one of the people making news.
Actually, today we have two people making news on KCBS In Depth. They are Gordon Grebb and Mike Adams. Mr. Grebb is an emeritus professor at San Jose State University. He has an extensive background in radio. He started out as a child actor at the age of 12. He's worked as a reporter and in radio station management as well as being an educator. Mr. Adams is the chairman of the Department of Television, Radio, Film, and Theater at San Jose State and also has an extensive background in radio. And together they have written Charles Herald, Inventor of Radio Broadcasting. I'm Mike Pulsifer with Ed Cavanero. We appreciate both of you being with us today. We're going to have you tell most of the story, but briefly, Charles Herald, known as Doc Herald, licensed a radio station. In 1921, the station was called KQW, and in 1949, it became KCBS. Now let's have you tell more of the story. And first of all, you are convinced that KCBS, in that previous form, was the nation's first radio station.
Well, this is Gordon Grebb speaking. I want you to get acquainted with my voice because Mike will be speaking in a moment. But I'm the person who didn't believe it when I first ran into it in 1958, which is quite a long time ago, when somebody showed me a strange-looking telephone mouthpiece and said, this is a radio station that was in San Jose in 1909, and I didn't believe it. I didn't follow this up till several years later when I joined the faculty at San Jose State, and when I called the management of KCBS and said, do you have any documentation in the files? Even Maury Webster, the manager, didn't know. So thus began a long-time investigation, and fortunately I was joined by Mike Adams, and so we've put the story together in a book.
It says inventor of radio broadcasting. That's quite a claim. Mm-hmm. First, I guess we should define what you mean by broadcasting.
Okay, well, we went to the Smithsonian, where the great collection called the Clark Papers is held, because we asked the question, what is radio broadcasting? And apparently, the man named George Clark, who was the RCA historian, collected everything to do with broadcasting or radio between 1900 and when he died in 1950. And he, in 1920, said, this is what broadcasting is. It has to be entertainment or information, using wireless, they called it then. It has to be broadcast on a regular basis, or in other words, starting a radio station. It has to be pre-announced in the press, and it has to be for a known citizen audience. And that one word, citizen, was why Clark discounted people like Herald, because Herald did have an audience. And we found out from our research at the Smithsonian that Herald had an audience that was more than just experimenters, as Clark claimed. And conversely, KDKA, and they had the very first license given by the Commerce Department in 1921 or 1920, KDKA's audience were mostly experimenters, and later citizens came to radio. So we have proved that Charles Herald broadcast beginning in 1909 or 1910 continuously until World War I, when all broadcasters were taken off the air.
So it sounds like it is programming for a wide audience.
Exactly.
Is that fair to say? Tell us about that early programming. What was it?
Well, the early listeners were a mixed bag. In other words, you had ships in San Francisco Bay with ships' wireless operators on it that heard this strange music and talk coming from San Jose. Doc Herald would say, this is Doc Herald in the Garden City Bank building. Can you hear me? I'm going to play the Trail of the Lonesome Pine. And these guys were absolutely astounded. You had little kids that were intrigued with making crystal sets and wanting to be wireless operators. They also heard it. So he had these people. And then Herald himself, by the year 1912, we can prove it by stories in the San Jose Mercury, he was advertising the fact and telling the general public, ask somebody who has a crystal set or a receiver to let you hear our programs because we're on the air all the time.
You mentioned KDKA. I think we should talk just a little bit about mm-hmm. that. KDKA mm-hmm. is in Pittsburgh.
Yes.
And how did it develop? What was the story there?
Well, KDKA's claim to fame was that it broadcast the Hughes-Wilson election returns of November 1920. I'm sorry, not the Hughes-Wilson, but the Harding-Cox election. Hughes-Wilson, that was 4 years earlier, and Lee DeForest actually broadcast that. But KDKA had to get a special license in 1920 to go on the air, and they received an amateur license, but then there was something called a commercial license. So they were given a license and allowed to use the call letters KDKA. And they claimed to be the first broadcaster because they were the first licensed by the Commerce Department. When Herald was on the air, there was really no licensing for commercial stations, and thus the claim.
May I add to that? Because Harold himself in 1925 knew about KDKA, and when he examined the records of the stations then on the air, in 1925, Harold gave KDKA the credit of being the oldest station in the nation. He never claimed to be the oldest station, but he did claim to be the first. And so my hat is off to KDKA. I admire that station back in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And in no way do we take any credit away from the pioneers that did many other important things in broadcasting. But we do maintain that the credit should go to Harold as being first.
And I wanted to ask you, did Doc Harold and Lee DeForest work together in any ways? Did they know each other or anything like that?
They did in later years correspond by letter, and we actually have the letters, and I think we use some of the information in the book. And actually, Gordon interviewed Lee DeForest in the 50s.
Yes, I did. Well, Lee DeForest actually was in Palo Alto in 1912 working with the people who were developing the Federal Telegraph System, which was wireless. And they were using a Poulsen arc, which reached out over the Pacific Ocean. It was great for commercial traffic. But at that time, I don't believe Lee DeForest knew Harold or Harold knew him. Even in 1915, when Harold came to the Panama Pacific Exposition to demonstrate his new tube operation, he couldn't get his transmitter to work. So the radio inspector said, let's asked Charles Harold to extend his programming so that he's on the air all day long, all night long, and then we will have music coming from San Jose that Lee DeForest can pick up. So at that time, Lee DeForest first knew of Harold, but later on, as Mike said, they corresponded, and Lee DeForest, when I interviewed him in his home in Los Angeles in 1959, if he said this station is still on the air, I give him credit for being the first. We've got that on tape.
We don't want to get too technical, but his technical operation, his invention, was a little different than what we, the way we broadcast radio now, correct?
Yes. In our research, we determined that there were three competing technologies between 1900 and 1920. The first was spark gap, which Marconi began to use in 1900 for two-way communication. It was tried and discarded as a carrier of voice. The next was the Poulsen arc, and that's what DeForest used in 1906 to broadcast one or two programs of opera, and also what Harold used between 1912 and 1917. To broadcast an actual DC arc, a very kind of like think of the street lights and hook a microphone up to it. Very, very crude, but it was a better carrier of voice than spark. But meanwhile, Lee DeForest, who invented the Audion, I don't want to get too technical, as a detector of radio in 1906, sold it to the phone company in 1915 as an amplifier of long distance phone calls. And in 1916, Lee DeForest made his vacuum tube oscillate and began to use that as broadcast technology. So after the war, of course, Harold's technology was obsolete.
And back to the early days, beginning with those first programs, he had regularly scheduled programs broadcast mm-hmm. continually. Is that correct?
Yes. Harold and his wife and his students, and because I'm the advisor to KSJS, the college station at San Jose State University, I tell the students that really it was their enthusiasm, I think, that caused this to happen. We have two pieces of what we call the smoking guns of early broadcasting, and we did extensive research. We spent a week at the Smithsonian, the New York Public Library, and the Antique Wireless Archives in upstate New York, trying to ask the question, who was first and who else was doing what Harold was doing. And what we found were two documents. This first one we call the smoking gun of who was first, and it was a 1910 catalog of a company called Electro Importing Company in New York. And their idea was to sell wireless parts so kids could build wireless sets. And so they asked Harold to do a notarized statement of how he was using their technology. And in the 1910 catalog, he said, "We have been giving wireless concerts to amateur men in the Santa Clara Valley." Wow. I mean, this is broadcasting. 2 years later, we have this story in the San Jose Mercury Herald, which we couldn't find locally. We had to go to New York to find it. And this reporter says, for several hours, I was in Charles Harold's office, and his students conducted a broadcast, and they were playing records, and they would ask their audience, what record do you want to hear? Students would call in. The students would play the record on the air, request radio in 1912. And this went on and on, including Harold's wife being the first.
I could add to that because I interviewed Mrs. Mrs. Harold, who by this time had remarried and was called Mrs. True, in 1959, and she recalled doing a weekly program for what she called the little hams, the little amateur wireless people out there. And she was taking requests and going down to Sherman and Clay and borrowing records. And it was a very popular program as early as 1912. And the only reason that Harold didn't continue and became famous is that World War I came along, and President Wilson, for security measures, shut down all private radio and wireless stations, and Harold was forced to go off the air.
Radio is our subject on KCBS In-Depth. Our guests are Mike Adams and Gordon Grebb. With Ed Cavanero, I'm Mike Pulsifer. I still want to talk about more on the early days because I want to grasp the concept. I mean, now when we want to listen to the radio, we walk over to the radio, we turn it on, and there it is. Was that the way it was then when Doc Harold was around?
Well, yes, it was. Well, no, it wasn't, actually. You had to actually build a radio, and you had to go out of your way. And because there were no assigned frequencies, no assigned call letters, you had to actually wind a coil of wire around an oatmeal box. You had to buy a piece of galena, which is sand, I guess, which acted as a detector of radio. It somehow, as a rectifier, it converted radio frequency into audio frequency. So you had a coil of wire you wound, or you could buy it, maybe, through a catalog. You had a small galena detector, and you had a pair of earphones, and you had an outside antenna and ground, and you experimented trying to find a sensitive spot on the crystal to pick up what was there. And, of course, what was there between 1900 and 1920 was almost 99% ships at sea, traffic between ships and land stations, but it was coded. It was Morse code. And so people who were building these radios were very surprised when they heard music or someone reading the headlines from the Mercury Herald.
Was there much enthusiasm for this in the early days, or was it confined to enthusiasts?
Well, this is what got it going, and the reason that Harold stayed on the air. I say that there was no such thing as non-commercial broadcasting, because if you analyze why did Harold go on the air and stay on the air, it's because it was advertising his College of Wireless and Engineering. And because the kids out there were listening to it, they thought, well, maybe I'll go down and enroll in his school and take wireless and become a ship's wireless operator or get a job with the, you know, later on in World War I came along, Harold ended up educating kids so they could go to work for the Army Signal Corps or work in the Navy as wireless operators. So sure, he was advertising his school.
Was Harold's first programming all music, or what else did he do on the air?
Well, I guess we have to look at the other inventors besides Harold during that period of time, and the three that we profiled in the book were Reginald Fessenden and Lee DeForest and also Charles Harold. And we looked at these three in the context of what people wanted to do during that time period. What Marconi did was find a wireless replacement for the wired telegraph. And what Harold was actually trying to do, along with DeForest and Fessenden and others, was to find that wireless replacement for the wired telephone. And so Harold was more of an inventor experimenter who really thought, gee, I can make some money if I invent a way to send voice over the wireless. But because his students and his wife got interested in this, and as many of the experimenters said back in those days, I just cranked up a record player and aimed it toward the microphone just to save my voice, because we were experimenting trying to make this technology. And so we kind of maintained this came about accidentally. I mean, there was no model for this at all. And the microphone he made was based on a telephone. It was a carbon microphone, just like the early telephone transmitter. And so, this was quite revolutionary, but all of a sudden it happened. All of a sudden people were listening and saying, gee, you know, I really like this. I can hear music on the air. And the San Jose Mercury News in that editorial of 1915 said, what is this going to do for live entertainment? This is not fair that people are not going to go out anymore and socialize. They're going to stay home and hear it on the radio.
Well, also, you know, the quality of the records they were playing back in those days was mechanical. Yeah, the fidelity was lousy. That's why I realized I was in radio myself when I was very young. And in those days, there was an inclination to want to do live orchestras rather than play records. Why was that? Because records were so lousy until about 1926, 27, when they became electronically recorded. So there, it's understandable why the newspaper editor would say, well, we don't want this, because it's not the same thing as going to a live symphony or concert.
How soon did he start also reading news and community announcements over the air?
Well, according to the eyewitnesses, and Gordon did some audio taping of people who were alive and working for Harold, and we actually even have this man called Ray Newby on videotape, and he said that they planned things out ahead of time. They actually sat down and said, okay, we're going to go on the air at 9 o'clock at night. Here's today's newspaper, and they would cut out stories and say, you read this, and you read this, and they had a stack of records, and they would announce the records. But I believe they had a couple of live musicians come in and stand before a microphone. I mean, what an amazing thing this must have been. 10 years before, people thought broadcasting was invented.
What we're used to 24-hour radio stations, mm-hmm. obviously, now. What you mentioned 9 o'clock at night. I mean, what kind of hours did this station have?
They claimed to be on every day. 9 o'clock was in the newspaper. Harold actually was quoted in a 1912 or 1911 article in the San Jose newspaper saying, if you listen any night at 9 o'clock, you'll hear us. What I believe, and what the eyewitnesses and Harold's son, who both of us interviewed, said, was that they worked very hard learning Morse code and electricity and all this that a trade technical school that Harold owned would teach. And they worked very hard learning this. And at night, this was kind of a way to unwind and relax. Let's play some music and talk to our friends over the air. So this was a hobby, in a sense, that became much bigger, of course, than it really was.
Also, because at nighttime, the skyways would give you a longer distance, they felt they might have a larger audience. Because in some of the publicity, there's a story that we reproduce in the book in which Harold claims that he had an audience 300 miles away. But this would be at night.
You at least partially answered this earlier when you said you maintain this was mostly by accident that this happened. But how did Harold get interested in this in the first place?
I believe that Harold was the evidence is he loved young people. He used to actually take them camping. He built a cabin in the Santa Cruz Mountains. He used to take them camping on the weekend, and they would actually experiment and have fun with wireless. And I believe that the influence of his students, plus Harold was probably 35 or 40 when he met this 17 or 18-year-old co-ed at San Jose Normal School and married her. And we kind of, Gordon and I kind of suspect from talking to the son and the grandson that this was a way to do something social.
But also Harold said that at Stanford University when he was a student there in 1895, he had a professor. He had to switch from, he was starting out to be an astronomer. But his astronomy professor left to go back to East, and so he switched to electrical engineering. One of the professors there, and we cannot identify him yet, unfortunately, but a professor demonstrated the Marconi system right there in the classroom, and this thrilled Harold right from the very beginning. So while he didn't proceed to go into wireless experiments right away, it was in his head, and later on, when the opportunity came, I think he began to say, wireless might have a future, I'm going to go into it.
When did radios start becoming commercially available and then obviously really take off?
Well, Westinghouse saw the opportunity after the KDKA experiment, and Westinghouse thought, The way radio is going to support itself, they didn't like the idea of commercials, and no one really thought about advertising. They thought about it, but in a negative way. And they said, the way we're going to make this work is we're going to sell radios. And so under the RCA agreement, Westinghouse, RCA, those companies were going to control broadcasting, programming, and they were also going to sell radios. And so there were a couple of opportunities to buy these very primitive RCA crystal sets and one-tube sets about 1920. And this is why KDKA makes the claim as being having the first citizen audience. Yes, citizens could buy, but Gordon and I looked at some of the early radio magazines from 1920 through, say, 1923. They still referred to it as radio concerts, like Harold did, gradually talking about broadcasting. They still, most of the magazines were devoted to how to build a radio and how to get stations. It was still earphone-based until 1925. Radio was not plug-in furniture until 1928. So the 20s, you know, broadcasting was fully formed between 1920 and 1927. All the regulation, the networks were formed, the programming was in place, even the rating systems. Nothing new after 1928, probably.
You say they didn't start commercials right away, but I assume it didn't take long. When did that begin, and how did it begin?
Under the RCA agreements, Western Electric, their job was to build transmitters, and they also had in that clause, not only would Western Electric build transmitters, but they would be in charge of chain broadcasting and toll broadcasting. That's what they called it under the 1920 RCA agreements. WEAF, an AT&T Western Electric-owned station in 1923, I believe, or 20. 1922, was credited for doing the very first commercial for a housing development. But the thing is, other stations were doing commercials because stations had no sense of purpose to go on the air other than to promote something. Every grocery store that wanted to be on the air could apply for a license, and they would advertise their groceries all day. Most of these stations did not last after the Radio Act of 1927, but you couldn't stop it. And plus, AT&T said, you know, we don't want to really be in that business, so go ahead. There was an argument, though. Lee DeForest said radio should only be to broadcast opera to high-class people, or high-class music to people who care. And even Sarnoff of RCA said, boy, commercials, I don't know. I think we can make this by selling radio. So this happened gradually, but it was one of those things where you open the floodgates. Stations were doing commercials. How could you stop them? There was very little regulation.
I might add, too, that the Secretary of Commerce was Herbert Hoover, and this was the first agency in charge of licensing. And we've found quotations from Hoover. In fact, Harold himself mentioned it, in which Hoover deplored the prospect that radio might have advertising. Well, the fact of the matter is that everybody that sought a license was really trying to advertise its own, you know, car agency or bank or newspaper or even college or university. So that's how they sought to get publicity and promote their particular endeavor. But so that despite the fact that some people thought advertising might, you know, degrade this wonderful radio, it was inevitable what was going to happen.
And, you know, something even scarier, when you read the literature, after World War I and our involvement in it, the Defense Department, or what was then called the War Department, they wanted to be in charge of radio licensing. It almost happened. It was very, very close. I mean, we could be a nationalized radio service with 24-hour recruiting. You know?
Gordon Grebb and Mike Adams are our guests on KCBS In-Depth. We're talking about radio from the early days, literally. I'm Mike Pulsifer with Ed Cavanero. As radio became, for lack of a better phrase, more mainstream, was Doc Harold part of that? Did he join in?
Well, yes, after the war, of course, Doc Harold's technology was obsolete because the DeForest radio tube is now the new way of going. It was much, much more efficient and the way to go. And Harold had lost his business because being taken off the air, all he was left with was his college. And so he had to scrape up some money in order to buy the new Western Electric equipment and get back on the air. So that's one reason why he wasn't relicensed first. And he had to wait in line, and so in 1921, he became licensed as KQW. And then he had an endeavor to make money, and he was having a financial difficulty, so much so that he was on the air, no doubt about that, but he was endeavoring finally to get the station on some kind of a financial footing. So he offered it one time as a municipal station to the San Jose City Council. They were interested, but decided, no, they didn't want to put money into it. At the same time that this was happening, a station back in New York City decided to go on the air and be a municipal station. So San Jose's lost the opportunity to take over KQW. Ultimately, Harold, in order to enable the station to survive financially, made a deal with the First Baptist Church, and in 1925 and 26, it became it was a gift of Harold to the First Baptist Church. They kept him on for a year as their chief engineer.
I suppose everybody wants to know, because he invented this technology, mm-hmm. and you talked about making money. Did Charles Harold become a rich man because of this?
No, as a matter of fact, and it's sad, Charles Harold did several things. After the Baptist Church used the station for a couple of years, the Farm Bureau took it over and made it a very powerful farm information kind of station. It had a certain amount of credibility. Harold was not reemployed, though, by that organization, because he was basically their chief engineer and their chief technical person. But later on, Harold, in the late 20s and early 30s, became a time broker, and he put together programs for various Bay Area stations, Oakland, San Francisco, and San Jose. He sold time. He actually wrote a book called Advertising by Radio, and he wrote a very interesting, influential, I guess it's sort of a overgrown pamphlet, but it was a very interesting story. But the sad thing is that the evidence we have, Harold, as a 50 or 60-year-old in the early 1930s, had to get a job as an audiovisual technician in the Oakland City schools, putting slides together. He became a janitor at the Alameda Naval Station in the early 1940s. He went to a Hayward rest home in the mid-40s and died in the late 40s. Sad story for the father of broadcasting.
What did the call letters KQW stand for? Do we know?
Well, some people said it stood for King's Quickening Word, but we don't really know that because we know two things. We know that the FCC would assign call letters sequentially, and if you didn't ask for anything special, you would just get something because Harold had KQW before the Baptists took over. So, but they said, gee, KQW, King's Quickening Word, religious station. So we don't know that other than just a sequential assignment.
But even in the early days, it was not all religious programming. That was just part of the programming. What else did he have on the air?
Well, of course, Harold, like others throughout the early 1920s, even to the end of the 20s, would share time until 1927 when the interference got so bad that the Federal Radio Commission designed a system for allocating frequencies. All the stations were on two channels. They were on two frequencies right in the middle of what is the AM band. A station would go off at 6 o'clock. Another station would go on for an hour or two. They would go off if their transmitter broke early. Another station might come on accidentally and block out the other station. And so even in the 1920s, it was very difficult for a radio listener to know who was doing what. So it was very complex. And this is what the Radio Act of 1927 primarily set out to do, was to expand it to what we now know as 530 to 1600 kilocycles.
And was this basically happening only in San Jose and Pittsburgh in terms of really rapid development and serious development?
No, not at all. All the big cities had radio. New York was a big city then. Detroit was a big city. Los Angeles was not. So San Francisco was the major West Coast city. And so there were lots of radio stations in the Bay Area, and most of them do not exist anymore. Only a couple have actually survived. And, of course, the oldest one in the world is this one, KCBS.
And then was there sort of a boom, if you will, when people started realizing, wow, this thing is here, it's real, it works, and all of a sudden everybody was building and buying radio
stations? Absolutely. 1920s, the radio was, we call it the era of popularity. There were so many, nobody knew what to do with radio, so they did everything you could think of. And consequently, there were programs that were, you'd have birds singing in the background. They were selling bird seed, you know, and you had organ concerts. You had man on the street interviews, you know, to get the opinion of the ordinary citizen. And, of course, you had news, but news was very slow in developing in those days. Lots of people took it from the newspaper or from the wire services. Local news eventually develop, but you had, you know, all kinds of soap operas. You had entertainment programs like Amos and Andy, and you had people who were singers. I mean, and stations would we welcome anybody to come in. My father was on the air with a cowboy band. It was Walt Hay Bailers. He was on, you know, KQW, KLX, KROW, and he didn't get paid for this, but it was publicity for his band.
We all take it for granted, but radio really is magical. I mean, even in this high-tech world, there's nothing really like it, and it's free, and yet Doc Harold is kind of forgotten.
It's sad because Harold found a biographer in the 30s, and he wrote a giant editorial in the Oakland newspaper saying, I was the father of radio. No one remembers me. No one even knows who Charles Harold is. And he tried until he died to get some sort of recognition. And it was kind of sad because here we are trying to do something about the father of radio.
Gentlemen, we are out of time. Thank you so much for being with us today. Our guests on KCBS In-Depth have been Mike Adams and Gordon Greb. They are the authors of Charles Harold, Inventor of Radio Broadcasting. With Ed Cavanero, I'm Mike Pulsifer, KCBS All News 74.
You've been listening to KCBS In-Depth, a news interview program heard every Sunday at 8:30 a.m. and 8:30 p.m. KCBS In-Depth is produced by Cheryl Rains.